Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we have another doubleheader for you. Later on, we'll talk to Steve Cullen of Light Buckets about an innovative service that offers everyone an affordable opportunity to use wonderful, expensive telescopes without buying them. Let's begin today exploring supernova hunting in your spare time with Tim Puckett. Tim was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and for the last 33 years, he's been an amateur astronomer and astrophotographer. But as you'll learn, the only thing that's amateurish about Tim is that he doesn't get a W-2 form at the end of the year for his astronomy work. Tim's photos of comets and deep sky objects have been published in books and magazines in 17 different countries. His work has also been featured on television on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, BBC, the Discovery Channel, and the Learning Channel, and also Good Morning America. Tim is a pioneer in the field of digital astrophotography using CCD imaging systems, and he has owned and operated CCD cameras since 1989. He's built several robotic telescopes and is currently operating an automated supernova search with a team of volunteers working on three telescopes, including a 24-inch telescope that Tim built all by himself over a period of nearly 9 years. So, Tim, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, supernova are one of the most important of all astronomical sightings. And in fact, it's been one of the really key efforts by professional astronomers over the last couple decades. And one of the things that they've discovered is that our universe is not just expanding, but that the expansion rate is accelerating. And that was first discovered using supernova. So it's amazing how much we've learned about supernova. Tim, why is it that you're so excited about finding supernova?
Well, when I got started, I started taking astrophoto pictures for the simple reason that I had looked at an eclipse when I was a young child without any protection, and I didn't have very good night vision. And so what others would see in a telescope, I really couldn't see too well. So when I got started, I started strictly in photography, and so I was looking at pictures. That was fine for a few years, but after shooting the same old objects over and over, I'd get a little bored with it. I wanted to do something at least that was different. So what got me started in it really was I was focusing on an image to take a regular photo and noticed a star in the frame that was unknown to me. And so the first discovery that I made was serendipitous, but after that I really got the bug and decided I really wanted to continue to try to find them.
And you've told me that your group has found a total of about 210 supernova?
We serendipitously discovered one in 1994. At that time, I wasn't finished with the large telescope yet. We started with some smaller telescopes and a dedicated search in 1998. Then shortly a couple years after, we added the large scope when it was finished. But we started in 98 a dedicated search specifically to find supernovae. And obviously, the main interest was to try to find the supernovae on the rise.
By that, Tim, you mean as they're getting brighter?
Right. You know, obviously, as professional astronomers use them to calculate the distance candle and help them with the various studies. And so it's very important to try to get initial observations on the rise. Obviously, with smaller instruments, that's a little bit harder to do. You need larger instruments, really, to monitor and take more exposures per observing night to try to get as many as possible. Mm-hmm. When we first started, we were able to obtain anywhere from 500 galaxy images to 1,000 galaxy images a night. Now we have the capability of shooting about 4,000 to 5,000 galaxy images a night.
Do you look at the same galaxies every night?
Well, what we do is we have a list of about 15,000 galaxies, and we try to monitor that same list of galaxies over a period of about 4 to 5 days. Currently, the majority of the telescopes are located on the East Coast, and the weather is not very favorable there. Typically, we get one night of clear weather for every cloudy night. So at some point, I would like to try to move the telescopes out west where we can get a lot more observing time. We could go through the complete sample of galaxies faster, thus increase the discovery rate. As it is right now, we have about 210 discoveries.
I'm going to break in here for a moment to explain a few things about supernovae. A supernova is a cataclysmic explosion of a massive star. The flash of light from a supernova explosion can be, for several weeks or months, as much as 100 billion times brighter than our own sun. Fortunately, supernovae are generally very far away from Earth, and even beyond our own galaxy. Astronomers find supernovae when they see a new star suddenly appearing in a distant galaxy. Tim is going to describe how they do that, but basically it's by taking pictures every few days of thousands of galaxies and looking for something popping up that wasn't there before. By measuring a supernova's brightness and how rapidly that brightness rises and falls, and by carefully examining the colors of light that it emits, which is called spectroscopy, astronomers can figure out what type of star exploded and how far away it is. That distance is extremely important for our understanding of the universe. When astronomers find something new, they immediately let the world know by reporting the find to the IAU, the International Astronomy Union, which relays the information worldwide. Now back to Tim.
What they're interested in is getting precise photometric measurements of the stars. Essentially, when we make the discoveries, we make an initial photometric analysis of the brightness of the star when we first detected it, and then we do a confirmation follow-up image, and we report that. The fact that we are actively trying to find them with smaller instruments and bad weather, we don't actually have a full follow-up program to continue the photometry. When we send out a report to the International Astronomical Union, they have a list of private spectroscopists around the world that have access to very large telescopes. And as you well know, they take spectroscopic measurements of the stars to find out exactly, you know, what type of supernova explosion it is. So they can tell if it's a type 1 or a type 2, a 1B or a 1C. And so the spectroscopy is really what will tell you what type of explosion it is and what type of star system it is, whether it's a binary system or a core collapse.
The supernova that you're observing, how long do they typically last?
Depending on the type of supernova it is, it could last several weeks and then fade out of the detection of our instruments.
Mm-hmm.
There are some supernovas that we've found that, you know, would still be visible 6 months or a year later. So,
mm-hmm.
Which actually go back and fool the observers because they think they found another one until they find out it's in the same position. Typically what we're doing is I started scanning all the data myself for the first year or so, and what I quickly realized is that I'd have no personal life. And so I met with a friend of mine. His name is Alex Langusis, and he lived about 45 miles from my location. At the time, I was having to stay at the observatory every night and sleep on a couch and focus the telescopes every couple of hours to keep them in focus. As the night cools, the telescope shrinks, you have to refocus. So I was having to stay up all night long with the telescopes and try to work during the day, so it was very difficult. After the first year, what I did is we only had a 28K dial-up modem at the time, so I would drive half the distance and leave a CD-ROM in a vacant lot in a cement block, or basically the foundation of an old dilapidated building, and my buddy would go pick up his portion of the data, and he would link his data, and then we would coordinate by phone. As ISDN and DSL became available, then I was able to open up the program to really anybody who wanted to participate that had the skill level to work with us. And so now we have about 28 people in about 5 different countries that do this all on a volunteer level. They don't get paid. I don't get paid. We all do this just as a volunteer effort, as a hobby. And what they do is they have a sign-up sheet that they all go in and select a block of data that they want to blink. They report back in the candidate. They actually mark the FITS image and send it to me for evaluation if it seems like it's a possible candidate. Then what we do is I'll take a confirming shot. If it's real, we send in a report to IAU.
Tim, can you explain to our listeners what you mean by blink?
As it is right now, and as it has been since we started, what we do is we take an old image and a new image, and we will blink the two images together where they're flashing back and forth like once every half second. You'll see one image and then the other image. And so by blinking, we pretty much are able to detect any new stars that are in the field. Blinking is one way to do it. There are other groups that use image subtraction where they will subtract the new image from the old image and then look at the residual that's there, and if there's something new, only it will show up. The professionals use software to where they automatically, on the fly as the telescopes are running, will run an analytical software that will analyze the point spread of the stars and compare the star list or compare the images and will actually tell them almost in real time if they have a supernova, and they can actually go back, slew the telescope back 20, 30 minutes later and take another image of it. As it is right now, we don't have any type of software that'll do that automatically for us, so we're using humans to blink the images.
And you say you do 4,000 galaxies a night?
I don't do 4,000 galaxies a night, but our team might blink 4,000 images a night, where they may take a couple hundred images per person or something like that and blink, you know, 200 images apiece. But yeah, without a bunch of volunteers, there's just no way that this could continue.
And nowadays, with the more modern technology, you have these robotically operated telescopes. Does that include self-focusing?
Well, that's the great thing about it, is now not only will it slew to your target list that you can make up and feed the target list to the telescope every night, the telescope will slew to the zenith straight overhead. It will take the star in and out of focus, look at the basically a 2D plot of the star, decide the best focus for the telescope, and then continue on its run. It's gotten to the level now in the last few years where people can set up their automatic runs, and they'll run all night long, and it'll park the telescope and close the roof and basically do everything for them. I mean, obviously, the professionals have been doing this for decades, but, you know, the technology has filtered down to the amateurs in the last decade to where we can do it too.
How long an exposure do you need to take of each galaxy to get a significant result?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends on the aperture of your telescope. What we try to do is we try to match the exposure times to match the aperture of each telescope. So in essence, what we do is we take our different size telescopes, we run test exposures to see where we can obtain the same magnitude. Like if we want to image down to Mach 19, a smaller telescope may have a longer exposure to reach Mach 19 than a larger telescope. So anywhere from 20 to 60 seconds, or maybe 120 seconds, depending on the instrument, we try to match the same magnitude scale so that the all the survey goes down to the same depth. So anywhere from 20 to 120 seconds.
I see. And for those that are really new to astronomy, magnitude is a measure of the brightness of the object, and a larger magnitude means that the object is less bright. What's the magnitude limit a person can see by eye?
In typical skies, I think that, you know, in darker skies, I guess Mag 6.2, in my opinion, is about the visual limit. I'm a little bit challenged when it comes to night vision, but I believe that the average person by eye can see about magnitude 6.2.
I'd like to cut in again for a moment to let you know that in going from a magnitude 6 object to a magnitude 19 object, a difference of 13 units of magnitude reduces the brightness of the object by a factor of 150,000. So the galaxies that Tim and his friends are looking at are 150,000 times dimmer than the dimmest star that you could see with the naked eye. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we are talking about supernova hunting in your spare time with Tim Puckett, and also using top-quality telescopes without paying for them with Stephen Cullen. Remember, we're having a book drawing this month, so go to our website, guidetothecosmos.com, and email us your questions and suggestions for future show topics, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of my book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
Tim does all of these astronomy projects on his own time, but he also works in the astronomy industry, being a sales engineer for Apogee Instruments. And what does Apogee Instruments do, Tim?
Well, they make the CCD cameras that we actually use in our supernova search. And interesting story, I was a customer of this company for about 10 years. In 1994, I bought my first backlit and thin CCD from Apogee Instruments. Over the years, I bought more of the cameras and became friends with the owner. And very early in 2006, I went to visit the owner, and he said, well, you know, you do all this already. He said, how would you like to come to work for us and do this full time? And, you know, at the time, I thought it was a dream job because, you know, I'd be able to talk to professional astronomers all day long and talk to them about cameras. But anyway, it actually turned out to be a very good job. I turned down some other opportunities and took this job, and so far I've had a really good time there. And I guess I'm going into my fourth year now working at Apogee, so it's actually been pretty rewarding because I get a direct contact with all the, you know, amateurs and professionals.
What's the key feature of the Apogee CCD systems?
We sell so many different cameras that, you know, the cameras are anywhere from $4,000 up to $70,000. The thing that attracted me to Apogee in the first place was the low noise of the cameras, the fact that they offered the backlit, thin, super-sensitive CCDs, which, you know, at the time, in the early 90s, there were very few companies that were offering that. I was happy with the product, so at least it was good for me that I could go out and sell something that I honestly felt like that was, you know, a good product that I could stand behind because I had good results with the cameras when I was a customer.
Mm-hmm. The first image on our website shows the 24-inch telescope that Tim built for himself over a period of 9 years. Can you tell us something about this telescope?
Sure. I originally bought the mirror in 1988, and it took several years to get started. At the time, I didn't know anything about how to build a telescope. I had a friend who was an ex-machinist in the Navy. His name was George Roberts. He kind of brought me under his wing and taught me machining and welding, and, you know, he sort of got me started, and then he moved away. I think he got transferred a couple years after we started on it, so I kind of had to pick up with my initial lessons and kind of learn trial and error as I went. So that's why it took about 9 years to build. And then the second telescope I built, which is a 20-inch telescope, it took about 6 months to build. So it's interesting how well, after you do something once, it's so much faster to do it a second time.
Absolutely, yeah. Our second image shows Tim standing more or less underneath your so-called 24-inch telescope, and the telescope looks a lot bigger than 24 inches, so 24 inches is actually the size of the mirror. What is the size of the overall instrument itself?
The instrument itself weighs about 2.5 tons. It was built under the older design platforms where you want to basically overbuild the telescope, where it's like an old Tinsley or one of your Bowler and Chevins. You know, I didn't really have any funding. It was basically financed, you know, on a shoestring, and a lot of the steel came out of scrapyard. The design of the telescope was pretty much dictated by what parts and things I could find back in the salvage era. Now, as you know, they do recycling, and most all of your spare parts and pieces are now sent to recycling. But, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you could go into junkyards and places to find all sorts of neat things. So the design was actually dictated by what I could find.
Ah. And you say it weighs 2.5 tons?
Yeah, it weighs about 2.5 tons. It sits on a 3-foot by 4-foot concrete pier that goes down in the ground about 12 feet. And it's located in the North Georgia Mountains. It's about 100 miles from Atlanta. And then, as you know, I have several other telescopes that are now there with it, and they're all on the same patrol.
Is it located next to your house?
I actually live in Atlanta. When I purchased the land back in the early 90s, it had a house on the property. It wasn't much of a house, but it was a place to sort of stay on site to finish up the work on the buildings and, you know, get the telescopes ready. But I live in Atlanta and operate the telescopes remotely. Whether I'm 90 miles away or 2,000 miles away, as long as I have a web browser and an internet connection, I can pretty much run the telescopes from anywhere.
So you bought this property just specifically to install your telescope?
That's correct. It took about 2 years to find a really good piece of property. I wanted something with a really good view and something with a better altitude that'd get me above some of the haze. It took about 2 years to find the property. It was a pretty exhaustive search to try to find the right piece of property. Unfortunately, you know, light pollution is the bane of astronomers everywhere. As it is now, you know, 10 or 15 years later, the light pollution is encroaching there. So at some point, I really would like to move the telescopes out west somewhere in a dark location. As long as it has an internet connection, I'd be in good shape. But I really am actively looking for somebody or a partner or somebody who'd be willing to host the telescopes in their backyard, somebody that has a knowledge of, you know, hardware and can help out or want to join the search team.
So your telescope is on a concrete block that goes down 12 feet into the ground. How much concrete is that? How many tons?
I think it's a couple of yards of concrete. I think it was one complete concrete truck.
So you have an incredible passion for this work, don't you?
Well, it's just been a hobby that I wanted to pursue, and I'm almost 48 now. I spent a considerable amount of my youth working on all this. In hindsight, maybe I should have worked on becoming wealthy first and then buy the equipment, but just go out and buy it. But in any case, I picked the way that I did it, and I can't change that. But I guess the only good side about it is if something breaks, I know how to fix it.
So. Absolutely, yeah. Now tell us about image number 3 that's on our website, which shows the galaxy after on the left side and before the supernova exploded. Or what galaxy are we looking at?
It's just an example to show you what our blinkers blink. All this really is just one galaxy that shows the standard image that we take on a nightly basis without the supernova, and then you see an image with the supernova, which is basically just a little dot or a little star there that's, you know, showing up. So in essence, it's really a binary detection, but there's more that goes into it that our blinkers do. Some of the things that they have to do is whenever they think they have a candidate, they need to go and search a website to check and make sure that it's not already discovered before they send it in. Another thing that they need to do is they need to go to the Minor Planet Center database and check and see if there's a known asteroid in the field, because a lot of hunters in the past have been fooled by retrograde asteroids or asteroids that don't appear to move very fast. So they've actually reported erroneous reports. So we have to be pretty careful about what we report and the diligence as far as the blinkers. They go ahead and check for minor planets and recent supernovas and variable stars before they go ahead and submit it for a possible, you know, confirmation.
How do you go about being qualified to send in reports to the IAU?
Well, anyone can send a report into the IAU with a discovery. They do ask that the material be published ready. You know, they really expect the reports to be properly formatted, and they expect that the observation to actually be real. I think anybody can send a report in the first time, but I think, you know, after a few false alarms, I don't know how they would treat that, but that's one of the things we, and even the professional search teams, everybody really tries to be extremely careful about what they send in, because you don't want to cry wolf, because spectroscopy time on these large telescopes runs into thousands of dollars of time per hour, so you wouldn't want a group of professionals to get out there and try to start, you know, getting spectroscopy on a target that wasn't real. It would cost a lot of money and a lot of time.
So, Tim, after discovering 200-plus supernova, is there any one that really sticks out as being the most important of the whole group?
Well, I don't think there's any one supernova that would be the most important. I know that we've been written up, or at least our discoveries have been written up in numerous journals. A lot of our discoveries have been imaged by either Hubble or Chandra or some of the other space telescopes. I know that we've had a lot of research done on our discoveries. One in particular that was just timely and interesting was 2008 HA, which is a low luminosity, extremely low energy supernova, and that seemed to get a lot of press last year. One of the interesting things about it was that the year prior to that, I had allowed a 14-year-old teenager to become part of our search team, and she was actually able to do the work, send in reports, and her first discovery find actually ended up being this low luminosity, low energy supernova, and it got a lot of attention throughout the scientific community. A few months ago, the White House had a star party on the White House lawn. The president invited Caroline Moore, a 14-year-old girl, to be a guest of the president and the first lady to be at the star parties, which I thought was pretty interesting. That's probably the closest I'll ever get to the White House.
So this young lady really made good, huh?
Yeah, I think she's got a bright future. She seems to be very smart, very articulate. You know, just the find itself was so newsworthy. I think the news stations really picked up on her discovery and ran with it. And I'm not really sure where the final stance is on the paper. I know some groups are saying it was a supernova. Some groups are saying want to have a different classification for the supernova. So it certainly had a lot of interest.
So it's truly amazing that with the professionals spending billions of dollars for telescopes like the Keck and the Hubble and the Chandra, that it's still possible for an amateur, even building their own telescope, to make a contribution to science.
Well, that's true. There are certain things that we can still do as amateurs to contribute. One is to do what I'm doing, which is to try to find supernovae. There's also going to be extremely important follow-up programs to come. The LSST telescope, PanSTARRS network of telescopes, they have all these new surveys that are going to be coming online very soon. I think the days of amateurs finding supernova are not going to, you know, be around forever. But I do think that amateurs are going to have a significant follow-up role, following up on a lot of these candidates, producing astrometry and photometry of all these targets, because they're going to be generating so much data and so many targets that there really is going to have to be an army of people to follow up on all these things. While we still can find them in some successful manner, I'd like to continue finding the supernova until the chances dry up.
So do you have any words of wisdom to any young people who are interested in astronomy?
Well, I'd say the first thing that the parents can do is get them to the library or get them on the web and maybe buy them a small telescope. You can buy a small telescope for a few hundred dollars, get them out under the stars and get them interested in it. It doesn't have to be a profession, but it certainly is an eye-opening experience, especially for a child.
And if someone wants to contact you, do you have a website that you'd like to tell us about?
Sure. We're always looking for new volunteers to join the search team. Anybody who's interested can go to my website. It's cometwatch.com, and my phone number and all my information is right there on the website.
Okay, cometwatch.com.
Correct.
And Tim's website will be listed on my website, so if you didn't have a pencil handy when he gave you the website, you can just go to the same site that you got this audio program on, and you'll find a link to Tim Puckett and the Supernova Hunters.
So, oh, by the way, somebody just handed me a note. There actually is something very significant that I forgot to mention when you were asking us what one of the most important supernovas is. This is really interesting. 2005 EO and 2005 EN, we actually discovered two supernovae in the same galaxy at the same time. That's really cool.
Tim supplied us with an image of this double supernova, and that also has been posted on our website. Tim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now let's find out how you can get to use a great telescope without having to learn how to adjust all the knobs and without having to refinance your home. I'd like to welcome Steve Cullen, who's the president and founder of Light Buckets, which is a very innovative service being offered to the astronomy community that allows anyone, even a novice, to use some of the world's best telescopes without buying them. And to use those telescopes in some of the most pristine skies in the world without buying an airline ticket. Steve has been in technology almost all of his life and was recently a senior vice president at Symantec, who are the makers of Norton Antivirus and other internet security solutions. He's combined his deep knowledge of technology and his passion for astronomy to create a new innovative service that allows anyone to take beautiful pictures of distant galaxies while they're wearing their bathrobe at home. So Steve, tell us about Light Buckets. What do you have that you offer to the public?
Well, hi, Robert, and thank you for having me on the show. Light Buckets is a service that I started about 2 years ago when I took delivery of a 0.61-meter Ritchie Chretien, which is a 24-inch telescope that you'll typically find in research environments, and I bought it for my own personal use. It showed up at my house, and I was looking at this giant telescope that I've always dreamed of, and I thought, you know, I bet there's other people who have had the same dreams, and you know, I started thinking about how we could put the internet and other technologies together to allow people to have access to such an instrument, and that's what we've been doing for the last 2 years, is not only putting that telescope online, but we also have two others as well that people can log on to lightbuckets.com, choose a telescope and point it at pretty much any target in the sky that they're interested in and take some images of it.
And they get the data back through the internet?
Correct. All the information shows up in a private personal account on Lightbuckets, so they just go to their account area and they can view finished image either as a JPEG file or the raw science data that they can process themselves.
My goodness. And these telescopes are equipped with all the latest digital CCD cameras and so forth?
Absolutely. We are constantly looking for the latest and greatest technology to attach to these telescopes to give our customers the best experience possible. Right now we use some very high-end cameras from Apogee. One of them is the U42, which has a 90% quantum efficiency, which basically means that 9 out of every 10 photons from that distant object that people are trying to image actually show up in the finished image. So it's quite a powerful camera to put on a high-end telescope.
Yeah, that certainly sounds like a professional-grade instrument. So if you consider the telescope and the imaging system and everything else that you're offering, what would it actually cost somebody to buy all that?
Let's say our 0.61-meter Ritchie Chretien, which the telescope itself is over $200,000. The camera runs upwards of $40,000. And then, you know, of course, you've got all the other accessories, guide cameras and whatnot that go along with it. And then, of course, the structure and property, real estate that the observatory sits on. So, you know, when it's all totaled, you're probably looking northwards of $350,000 for that type of setup.
So this is more than a third of $1 million
absolutely.
Worth of equipment that someone could actually rent. And what would they have to pay to rent it?
We charge about $50 an hour for time on that particular instrument. The rate varies a little bit. You choose the image when the moon is up. We also provide a moon discount, which is based on how bright the moon is at that particular time.
And so here is a third of $1 million installation that someone could use for a few hours for just a couple $100.
That's it, absolutely.
And with the money they save, they could go out and buy this Maserati that Rob Gendler was talking about.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. And what sort of pictures do customers typically take?
Depending on the instrument, so we have three here at our Rodeo, New Mexico location. The 0.61 meter has a relatively small field of view of about 20 by 20 arc minutes, and so generally people take images of planetary nebula and close-in images of nebula, although they also like to take images of galaxy groups, you know, the AVO groups and such are also pretty popular targets because the instrument does provide a small field of view that can get those small, faraway galaxies to look quite big in the final image. Our 0.32-meter instrument is used generally for galaxies and some extended objects, emission nebulae, and things like that. And our new instrument, which is a 0.2-meter Newtonian astrograph, is really a wide-field instrument. It provides a field of view of about 100 by 70 arc minutes. And so really larger extended objects, Vail Nebula, M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, things like that get framed very nicely with that type of instrument.
I see. And what's the least expensive telescope to rent?
Let me just give you the prices. The 0.61-meter instrument is about $50 an hour. The 0.32 Ritchie Chretien is about $30 an hour. And the wide-field astrograph is also about $30 an hour.
And if someone wants to change the filters to capture different colors in the image, is that possible to do remotely?
Absolutely. One of the things about Light Buckets is not only do we provide these high-end instruments, but we've also dedicated quite a bit of time to creating a great web experience so that you have complete control over the instruments. And so not only can you select which filters, and we provide generally LRGB and then narrowband filters, so hydrogen alpha, S2, and O3 filters. We also provide the ability to rotate the field of view, so our Ritchie Chretiens have an instrument rotator, so you can frame the object just how you'd like, and we give you complete control over that through our web interface as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm surprised NASA doesn't run time on your telescope.
Not necessarily NASA, or not that I know of, but quite a few university researchers do use our instruments for times when they can't get on a particular instrument that they need, or, you know, a lot of university or higher-end instruments have a very small field of view, and a lot of times they don't want to do a bunch of mosaics or stitching images together, and so they'll use a wider field instrument that we provide. And so, you know, that's really an advantage that we offer for people in a research environment.
My brother is a high school physics teacher, and he's now teaching a class in astrophysics. Do you offer any student discounts or anything like that?
We have group accounts, and so if a school or an astronomy club wishes to buy a bunch of points in bulk, they can set up a group where there will be a group moderator who divvies up the points amongst the members, and then they can share points and then share their image data, but each person still has their own individual account, and so it allows everybody to set up their own imaging runs, get their own data. We'll also tailor some programs for schools. So I just did some work with a school system in the Cincinnati, Ohio area, helping them to start getting online with their astronomy and physics courses. You know, we welcome everybody to contact us about anything special that they might be looking to do.
This is an incredibly innovative service. It's amazing that anybody in the world could now take a picture through some of the finest telescopes available at such an incredibly reasonable price. I mean, it's even cheaper than buying some of these images that are taken by somebody else, and here you have your very own creation.
Yeah, I think that is really one of the cool features about Light Buckets is that anybody, whether you're just looking to get into astronomy or you're a hobbyist in astronomy, an astrophotographer, or all the way up to a university researcher, our instruments offer something for you in terms of your astronomy passion and just figuring out what it is you want to do with astronomy. We're here for you. It is a really amazing opportunity now.
And certainly if anyone is thinking of investing tens of thousands of dollars or even more in buying a telescope, it would make sense for them to try out some of your telescopes and see which one they're most comfortable with before they make that great investment.
You bet. Light Buckets really does provide a great try before you buy environment for people thinking of buying high-end instruments. You know, you can get onto Light Buckets, try out a high-end RC Optical Systems Ritchie Chretien, see the results you get, and make a decision whether it's worth it or not. But I'll warn you, you'll get hooked.
Okay, so once again, Steve, what's the website that they can reach you at?
The website is www.lightbuckets.com.
And for those of you that might be in your car listening without a pencil handy, I will have a link to that website on my website, and that is guidetothecosmos.com. So, Steve, thank you very much for joining us today and telling us about this really remarkable service.
Thanks for the opportunity, Robert. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you joined us today to hear about these surprising opportunities for amateur astronomers, for people who study the stars just because they love it. Now even amateurs can affordably access professional quality telescopes located under the pristine skies of New Mexico and make their own important and exciting discoveries. You can now control a state-of-the-art telescope and imaging system that are thousands of miles away and get back spectacular images that you have yourself created. And do all this remotely, over the internet, from the comfort of your own home or office. You too can enjoy being an astronomer and advancing science without having to sell the ranch to buy some exotic equipment. Remember, you can see all the images that we discussed today and find all the website links at guidetothecosmos.com. Thank you for joining us, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.